Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC, and now live coverage of President Obama's second inauguration. The official ceremonies are scheduled to begin in about 25 minutes. In the meantime, we'll talk to an all-star cast of Ken Davis, Clarence Page, and New York Times Obama correspondent Jody Cantor. And we've been collecting your suggestions for memorable lines that the president could say in his inaugural address today, memorable and very meaningful lines for today's world, like when President Kennedy said, "Ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country," or when FDR said, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself." So, for example, Jeff on Twitter submitted, we don't have to have every answer, but we need to be listening to every question. Amanda on Twitter, with a riff on Reagan and the Clintons' line about government is not the solution, says, "Government is not the solution to all our problems, but lack of good government is a problem we can't afford." Ryan on Facebook wrote, "It's time to bring back the United in United States of America." And we'll give you more examples as we go. But first, let's go live to Washington, D.C., where Chicago-based columnists, syndicated through the Chicago Tribune and Newsday and other national publications, Clarence Page is braving the cold. Hello from New York, Clarence. Thanks so much for giving us a few minutes. How's the mall?
Well, thank you for giving me a few minutes, Brian. And this is not cold compared to Chicago, so I'm a hale and hearty soul. But the mall is quite excited. I can't give you an exact crowd count, but it looks the same as it did 4 years ago to me. I call it Obama Fest. There's a real joyful flag-waving spirit going on here, helped along by the fact that thousands of flags have been given out, and they're being waved whenever someone who the crowd loves is paraded across the big Jumbotron.
How would you compare the mood today, Clarence, to the emotional and historic inauguration of our first black president, also around Martin Luther King Day, 4 years ago?
That's right. I would say that it's slightly more subdued, but that's not saying much because the energy was so high 4 years ago and the anticipation. There's a more realism in the air now. People realize, of course, that there's a big job to be done. Folks here are happy that Obama was reelected. At the same time, you know, I've heard people talk about various issues that they hope that he will address that he didn't get around to addressing in the first term or didn't get to complete.
And what are your own hopes and expectations for the speech today and for the president's second term, for that matter?
Well, number one, I hope it will be more inspiring than his speech 4 years ago. I was disappointed. I think a lot of us, you know, with the big buildup of his wonderful pre-election speeches that we've seen, expected a little more poetry and a little more inspiration in the speech. I can't find anybody who can quote me any lines from the speech he gave 4 years ago. And also, he seemed, in a way, kind of, I don't know if nervous is the right word, but, you know, I'd certainly be nervous about to step off on a huge task like he had ahead of him. I expect him to be a lot more confident looking this time, confident sounding, and I hope he will have a bit more inspiration in his voice because we need some inspirational spirit with the sluggish economy and with the very, very divided Washington politics that we have these days. And not to mention the troubles we have around the planet. I hope he'll address not just gun control, but also immigration. That issue rose during the campaign with a big prominence. And I think Republicans are looking for leadership on that issue, too.
Chicago Tribune, Newsday, and syndicated columnist Clarence Page, thank you so much. Enjoy the ceremonies and the day on the mall.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And with us now, Kenneth C. Davis, author of books including Don't Know Much About History, Don't Know Much About the American Presidents, and many more in the Don't Know Much About series. Hi, Ken.
Good morning, Brian. Always a pleasure.
And we're seeing that President Obama just arrived at the Capitol building. Out on the podium, we see Bill and Hillary Clinton, Jimmy Carter. The first daughters have just been announced and seated. The president is being accompanied by Charles Schumer, so we have that New York hook at the inauguration today. Ken, do historians make rankings of the best inaugural addresses of all time or the best lines from inaugural addresses?
I think you've probably played some of them and you've been playing your right in your own best. And, of course, I think my two are Lincoln's first and second. Gee, he gets, you know, two of the greatest. 1861, where he was loath to close and he talked about the better angels of our nature. And then 4 years later, a very different set of circumstances with Malice Toward None.
And let's hear a little bit of that one. We've taken a 42-second excerpt, 47-second excerpt from YouTube with an actor. No, it's not Daniel Day-Lewis, but he's okay. So 1865, Lincoln's second inaugural address.
With malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right, as God gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who shall have borne the battle, and for his widow and his orphan, to do all which may achieve and cherish a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations.
So nice job there by a reenactor. Do you think Lincoln would have sat, and unfortunately I don't have the actor's name, but Ken Davis, do you think Lincoln may have delivered it something like that? Of course, there were no microphones in 1865.
Yeah, it's hard to extrapolate. We do know that Lincoln did have a kind of high, squeaky voice, it's said, even though we think of, you know, the Raymond Massey type deep baritone when we hear Lincoln. But that's the way Lincoln was described. And in fact, Daniel Day-Lewis was actually going for that in his interpretation, which got some criticism, by the way, when the movie was coming along. The piece of that speech that's not included there, and it's interesting, is because Lincoln really goes – the story is that he had gone from preserving the Union, obviously, to this was about slavery and ending slavery now. And he really takes after the slaveholders, and he talks about the 250 years of toil, and that blood will be spilled to pay that back. And that's a piece of inaugural speech that we don't hear, that kind of anger at those who have, in Lincoln's mind, done evil. FDR has a touch of that also, both in 1933 and in 1937. And in 1933 is, of course, the Fear Itself speech. 4 years later, he comes back and talks about the country still has tremendous anxiety. That would have been a good speech for Barack Obama to read or reread while getting this one ready.
And that 1933 speech, this time no reenactment, the actual thing, 30 seconds of FDR.
This great nation will endure as it has endured, will revive and will prosper. So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed effort to convert retreat into advance.
All right. So why do you think some of these lines get remembered as great and not just catchy? Lots of people can write a slogan, and I wonder if it's a little random which ones get into our hearts and into the history books and which ones get forgotten. And if we went through a lot of the forgotten inaugural addresses, we would find some fabulous and fabulously deep and meaningful lines.
We can absolutely do that. We can also find a lot of rote and pedestrian speeches that, I mean, Nixon's second 40 years ago in 1973, I think, you know, just about any politician could deliver that today because he talked about divisions. He talked about the work we have in front of us. All of those themes run through a lot of these, especially second inaugurals. What many of them lack, though, is poetry. And I think that that's what Lincoln had. That's certainly what Roosevelt had. And it's also obviously delivery. I mentioned Roosevelt's second in 1937. It's not as familiar as The Fear Itself, but it has some great pieces in it. But he talked about the importance of government answering the problems. He says government has the innate capacity to protect its people against disasters. Compare that, of course, to Ronald Reagan saying government is not the solution, but the problem. You have the essence of the argument in American history presented in these two inaugural addresses from two very different men.
So, listeners, here are some more of your submissions for a potentially memorable line that President Obama might use today. Ryan on Facebook, it's time to bring – oh, I read that one already. How about Gianni on our comments page? Can we all get along and get something done for the next 4 years? The American people and the world will appreciate it. Mark on Facebook, compromise contains both the hope and goal of promise. And if you don't get that, look at how compromise is spelled. And Barbara on Facebook, let's all give just a little bit more time, money, patience, or effort to your work, family, recreation, and country. So that will probably mean turning off the TV. Today. It's a little like, ask not what your country can do for you.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. My fellow citizens of the world, ask not what America will do for you, but what together we can do for the freedom of man.
And Ken Davis, people don't remember the line that followed, ask what you can do for your country. He's addressing the entire world. Ask not what America will do for you, but what together we can do for the freedom of man.
That's right, because remember the atmosphere. We forget there once was a Cold War. We're talking about the cold weather, but the Cold War was the moment at which Kennedy comes in as a kind of crusading anti-communist, and of course much of his administration would be involved with that. But this idea of the triumph of democracy over communism was the theme that was coursing through his speech as well as his administration.
And so in a way, and we heard Clarence Page say he hopes President Obama is more inspiring today because he wasn't that inspiring in 2009. Of course, we were deeply at the bottom of the financial crisis at that very moment. And he gave a pretty tough personal responsibility speech that had an echo of Ask Not. Let's recall Barack Obama in 2009, January 20th, of course.
That we are in the midst of crisis is now well understood. Our nation is at war against a far-reaching network of violence and hatred. Our economy is badly weakened, a consequence of greed and irresponsibility on the part of some, but also our collective failure to make hard choices and prepare the nation for a new age.
So pretty tough love for somebody who had just run on hope and change.
Absolutely, and not one that we put down on the carve on stone. What I'm sure we won't hear, by the way, as we talk about what we're going to hear, is George Washington's second, which has the notoriety of being the shortest second inaugural speech, 135 words. He basically said, I'm here to take the oath. If I break any laws, I'm sure you'll come after me. And that was it. Very short and sweet. You know, we can say an awful lot, though, in 2.5 minutes, the Gettysburg Address. 2.5 minutes Lincoln spoke, apparently, perhaps still the greatest speech in American history. So sometimes brevity is the soul of wit.
Ken Davis, Kenneth C. Davis, author of the Don't Know Much About series, including Don't Know Much About History and Don't Know Much About the American Presidents. Thanks so much for coming in on this inauguration day.
Always a pleasure. We'll be looking forward to it.
We are about 10 minutes from the start of the ceremony, and Jody Cantor, author of The Obamas and New York Times Obama correspondent, will help talk us up to it right after this. Brian Lehrer with you on WNYC as it's live coverage of President Obama's second inauguration. The official ceremonies are scheduled to begin at 11:30. And let's talk to New York Times Obama correspondent Jody Cantor, author of the book, The Obamas. Hi, Jody. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks so much, Brian. Hi from D.C.
And you wrote in the Times yesterday that the man who once hoped to change Washington now warns job applicants that it can be hard to get anything done. Has the hope and change president become disillusioned?
I don't know if disillusioned is the right word. And of course, you know, as always, I lack my magic instrument for reading Barack Obama's mind precisely. But what we do see is a guy who is, in a way, much more of a warrior. I think my favorite word that somebody used to me to describe the president when I was reporting that story was bloodier-minded. And I thought that was such a great phrase because we don't really think of Barack Obama as bloody-minded at all. And yet his desire to beat Republicans, sense of being a sort of more hardened political figures, especially after the attacks of the first term, is very strong. Now, things have quieted down a bit, but remember that not that long ago, people were saying that Barack Obama wasn't an American, that he was a socialist, that his health care plan was going to involve government-sponsored execution of grandmothers, et cetera, et cetera. So this is a guy who has suffered through some really extreme political attacks. And we see a guy who is hardened and who's determined to pass his agenda. Although, I think we can also say he's going to have a very hard time. As I watched the budget battles unfold in Congress recently, I just think the question we all have to ask ourselves is, well, you know, the president wants to do gun control. He wants to overhaul immigration laws. He even wants to do energy and environmental overhauls. Is that really going to happen when even a budget deal can't get passed?
Now, President Obama is moving toward the stage. He's wearing a blue tie, we will note, not the carefully bipartisan purple that he wore for many of the debates. Chuck Schumer is there with a red tie next to him, waving to the crowd. So maybe the blue and the red make purple. And Jody Cantor, you wrote that the president is bloodier minded when it comes to Republicans, and that the president grew offended when John Boehner failed to return his multiple phone calls during the fiscal cliff negotiations at the end of the year. You say the old Barack Obama would have considered the who calls whom protocols stupid. Why did the new Barack Obama care?
The new Barack Obama, and let's stipulate, right, that Barack Obama is a pretty steady character. We're not talking about a politician who kind of swings through wild self-reinventions every couple of years. But the change we see is that this is a guy who is much more girded for the fight. He used to refer to Washington budget battles as kabuki, meaning they're dumb, they're pretend, they're these sort of rhetorical battles that are divorced from what's really going on in the country. I thought a fascinating recent moment was watching the president at the appearance he did on New Year's Eve. This was right before the deadline for the fiscal cliff was going to come up, and things were still not resolved. Now, the president was standing there in front of the cameras. He hates budget battles, so I expected him to look pretty unhappy. He was also missing part of his cherished Christmas vacation in Hawaii with his family, so I expected him to look unhappy. Instead, he had this mischievous smile on his face. And as a reporter, my question was, who is this new Barack Obama who is gleefully savoring these budget clashes in Congress? So I think that's part of the change.
And I think they're about to start with Chuck Schumer, the chairman of the inaugural, introducing the president.
Now, This is the 57th inauguration of an American president. And no matter how many times one witnesses this event, its simplicity, its innate majesty, and most of all its meaning, that sacred yet cautious entrusting of power from we the people to our chosen leader never fails to make one's heart beat faster, as it will today with the inauguration of President Barack H. Obama. Now, we know that we would not be here today were it not for those who stand guard around the world to preserve our freedom. To those in our armed forces, we offer our infinite thanks for your bravery, your honor, your sacrifice. This democracy of ours was forged by intellect and argument, by activism and blood, and above all, from John Adams to Elizabeth Cady Stanton to Martin Luther King, by a stubborn adherence to the notion that we are all created equal and that we deserve nothing less than a great republic worthy of our consent. The theme of this year's inaugural is faith in America's future. The perfect embodiment of this unshakable confidence in the ongoing success of our collective journey is an event from our past. I speak of the improbable completion of the Capitol Dome and capping it with the Statue of Freedom, which occurred 150 years ago in 1863. When Abraham Lincoln took office 2 years earlier, the dome above us was a half-built eyesore. Conventional wisdom was that it should be left unfinished until the war ended, given the travails and financial needs of the times. But to President Lincoln, the half-finished dome symbolized the half-divided nation. Lincoln said, "If people see the Capitol going on, it is a sign we intend the Union shall go on." And so, despite the conflict which engulfed the nation and surrounded the city, the dome continued to rise. On December 2, 1863, the Statue of Freedom, a woman, was placed atop the dome where she still stands today. In a sublime irony, it was a former slave, now free American, Philip Reed, who helped to cast the bronze statue. Now, our present times are not as perilous or as despairing as they were in 1863. But in 2013, far too many doubt the future of this great nation and our ability to tackle our own era's half-finished domes. Today's problems are intractable, they say. The times are so complex, the differences in the country and the world so deep, we will never overcome them. When thoughts like these produce anxiety, fear, and even despair, we do well to remember that Americans have always been, and still are, a practical, optimistic, problem-solving people, and that as our history shows, no matter how steep the climb, how difficult the problems, how half-finished the task, America always rises to the occasion. America prevails, and America prospers. And those who bet against this country have inevitably been on the wrong side of history. So, it is a good moment to gaze upward and behold the Statue of Freedom at the top of the Capitol Dome. It is a good moment to gain strength and courage and humility from those who were determined to complete the half-finished dome. It is a good moment to rejoice today at this 57th presidential inaugural ceremony, and it is the perfect moment to renew our collective faith in the future of America. Thank you, and God bless these United States.
New York Senator Chuck Schumer, chairman of the Joint Congressional Committee on Inaugural Ceremonies.
Civil rights leader Merle Evers, who has committed her life to extending the promise of our nation's founding principles to all Americans. Mrs. Evers will lead us in the invocation.
And as she takes the podium, she was chair of the NAACP from 95 to 98.
America, we are here, our nation's capital, on this day, January the 21st, 2013, the inauguration of our 45th president, Barack Obama. We come at this time to ask blessings upon our leaders, the President, Vice President, members of Congress, all elected and appointed officials of the United States of America. We are here to ask blessings upon our armed forces, blessings upon all who contribute to the essence of the American spirit, the American dream. The opportunity to become whatever our mankind, womankind, allows us to be. This is the promise of America. As we sing the words of belief, "This is my country," let us act upon the meaning that everyone is included. May the inherent dignity and inalienable rights of every woman, man, boy, and girl be honored. May all your people, especially the least of these, flourish in our blessed nation. 150 years after the Emancipation Proclamation and 50 years after the March on Washington, we celebrate the spirit of our ancestors, which has allowed us to move from a nation of unborn hopes and a history of disenfranchised votes to today's expression of a more perfect union. We ask, too, Almighty, that where our paths seem blanketed by thorns of oppression and riddled by pangs of despair, we ask for your guidance toward the light of deliverance, and that the vision of those who came before us and dreamed of this day, that we recognize that their visions still inspire us. They are a great cloud of witnesses, unseen by the naked eye, but all around us, thankful that their living was not in vain. For every mountain, you gave us the strength to climb. Your grace is pleaded to continue that climb for America and the world. We now stand beneath the shadow of the nation's capital, whose golden dome reflects the unity and democracy of one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Approximately 4 miles from where we are assembled, the hallowed remains of men and women rest in Arlington Cemetery. They who believed, fought, and died for this country. May their spirit infuse our being to work together with respect, enabling us to continue to build this nation. And in so doing, we send a message to the world that we are strong, fierce in our strength, and ever vigilant in our pursuit of freedom. We ask that you grant our president the will to act courageously but cautiously when confronted with danger and to act prudently but deliberately when challenged by adversity. Please continue to bless his efforts to lead by example in consideration and favor of the diversity of our people. Bless our families all across this nation. We thank you for this opportunity of prayer to strengthen us for the journey through the days that lie ahead. We invoke the prayers of our grandmothers who taught us to pray, God, make me a blessing. Let their spirit guide us as we claim the spirit of old. There's something within me that holds the reins. There's something within me that banishes pain. There's something within me I cannot explain. But all I know, America, there is something within. There is something within. In Jesus' name, in the name of all who are holy and right, we pray. Amen.
The President and Mrs. Obama looking down as the invocation was read by Merle Evers Williams, widow of Medgar Evers and chair of the NAACP from 1995 to 1998. She is the first woman and first layperson, by the way, to give the invocation at a presidential inauguration. And she fought for 30 years to bring Medgar Evers' assassin, Byron De La Beckwith, to justice, which she finally did in 1994. Senator Schumer is now introducing the Brooklyn Tabernacle Choir. Now, for those of you who don't know it or are not members, the Brooklyn Tabernacle is a large church in downtown Brooklyn with 16,000 members. The choir has won 6 Grammy Awards. the Brooklyn Tabernacle Choir at the inauguration.
Please join me in welcoming my colleague and my friend, the Senator from Tennessee, the Honorable Lamar Alexander.
Mr. President, Mr. Vice President, ladies and gentlemen, the late Alex Haley, the author of Roots, lived his life by these six words: find the good and praise it. Today we praise the American tradition of transferring or reaffirming immense power in the inauguration of the President of the United States. We do this in a peaceful, orderly way. There is no mob, no coup, no insurrection. This is a moment when millions stop and watch, a moment most of us always will remember. It is a moment that is our most conspicuous and enduring symbol of the American democracy. How remarkable that this has survived for so long in such a complex country when so much power is at stake. This freedom to vote for our leaders and the restraint to respect the results. Last year at Mount Vernon, a tour guide told me that our first president, George Washington, once posed this question: what is most important, Washington asked, of this grand experiment, the United States? And then Washington answered his own question in this way: not the election of the first president, but the election of its second president. The peaceful transfer of power is what will separate our country from every other country in the world. So today we celebrate the 57th inauguration of the American president. Find the good and praise it. Now, it is my honor to introduce the Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, Sonia Sotomayor, for the purpose of administering the oath of office to the Vice President. Will everyone please stand?
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thanks for doing this.
Thank you. Mr. Vice President, please raise your right hand and repeat after me. I, Joseph R. Biden, Jr., do solemnly swear.
I, Joseph R. Biden, Jr., do solemnly swear.
That I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States.
That I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
Against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
That I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same.
I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same.
That I take this obligation freely.
That I take this obligation freely.
Without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion.
Without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion.
And that I will well and faithfully discharge.
And that I will well and faithfully discharge.
The duties of the office on which I am about to enter.
The duties of the office upon which I am about to enter.
So help me God.
So help me God.
Congratulations.
And as the Herald Trumpets perform ruffles and flourishes, and the U.S. Marine Band about to perform Hail Columbia, we'll give you one short program note. Justice Sotomayor will be a live guest tomorrow on The Brian Lehrer Show. That'll be 11 o'clock tomorrow morning here on WNYC. As we look ahead just a few minutes to the president swearing in, President Obama will take the oath upon the same Bible upon which Abraham Lincoln swore on March 4, 1861. And we will get back to our feed in just a second. He's also using the King Bible, which was Dr. King's traveling Bible. An avid reader who constantly was on the road, Dr. King typically traveled with a selection of books that included this Bible. It was used for inspiration and preparing sermons and speeches, including during Dr. King's time as pastor of Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery, Alabama. It's James Taylor singing, by the way.
God shed his grace on thee and crown thy glory with brotherhood from sea to shining sea. From sea.
It is my honor to present the Chief Justice of the United States, John G. Roberts, Jr., who will administer the presidential oath of office. Everyone, please rise.
Thank you, Senator. Please raise your right hand and repeat after me. I, Barack Hussein Obama, do solemnly swear.
I, Barack Hussein Obama, do solemnly swear
that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability
preserve, protect, and defend
the Constitution of the United States so help you God.
So help me God.
Congratulations, Mr. President. Well done.
Well, they got it right this time. Remember, there was a little problem in 2009 where Chief Justice Roberts made a small mistake administering the oath of office, and they had to do it a second time. In fact, Barack Obama is only the second president in U.S. history to be sworn in four times. The other was FDR because he was elected four times. In Obama's case, there were the two in 2009 because of the mistake. And this year, he was officially sworn in yesterday, January 20th, as the law requires. This swearing-in that you just heard was actually ceremonial as they moved the Sunday inaugurals to Mondays for the big ceremonies. Now they're doing a 21-gun salute. You're listening to WNYC AM, FM, and HD New York, WNJT FM Trenton, WNJO 90.3 Toms River, WNJY Netcong, and WNJP Sussex, as we are about to hear the inaugural address.
President of the United States of America, Barack H. Obama.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. Vice President Biden, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the United States Congress, distinguished guests,
and fellow citizens. Each time we gather to inaugurate a president, we bear witness to the enduring strength of our Constitution. We affirm the promise of our democracy. We recall that what binds this nation together is not the colors of our skin, or the tenets of our faith, or the origins of our names. What makes us exceptional, what makes us American, is our allegiance to an idea articulated in a declaration made more than two centuries ago. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. That they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Today, we continue a never-ending journey to bridge the meaning of those words with the realities of our time. For history tells us that while these truths may be self-evident, they have never been self-executing. That while freedom is a gift from God, it must be secured by His people here on earth. The Patriots of 1776 did not fight to replace the tyranny of a king with the privileges of a few, or the rule of a mob. They gave to us a republic, a government of and by and for the people, entrusting each generation to keep safe our founding creed. In four more than 200 years, we have. Through blood drawn by lash and blood drawn by sword, we learned that no union founded on the principles of liberty and equality could survive half slave and half free. We made ourselves anew and vowed to move forward together. Together, we determined that a modern economy requires railroads and highways to speed travel and commerce, schools and colleges to train our workers. Together, we discovered that a free market only thrives when there are rules to ensure competition and fair play. Together, we resolved that a great nation must care for the vulnerable and protect its people from life's worst hazards and misfortune. Through it all, we have never relinquished our skepticism of central authority, nor have we succumbed to the fiction that all society's ills can be cured through government alone. Our celebration of initiative and enterprise, our insistence on hard work and personal responsibility, these are constants in our character. But we have always understood that when times change, so must we. That fidelity to our founding principles requires new responses to new challenges. That preserving our individual freedoms ultimately requires collective action. For the American people can no more meet the demands of today's world by acting alone than American soldiers could have met the forces of fascism or communism with muskets and militias. No single person can train all the math and science teachers we'll need to equip our children for the future, or build the roads and networks and research labs that will bring new jobs and businesses to our shores. Now, more than ever, we must do these things together, as one nation and one people. This generation of Americans has been tested by crises that steeled our resolve and proved our resilience. A decade of war is now ending. An economic recovery has begun.
America's possibilities are limitless, for we possess all the qualities that this world without boundaries demands. Youth and drive, diversity and openness, an endless capacity for risk and a gift for reinvention. My fellow Americans, we are made for this moment, and we will seize it so long as we seize it together. For we, the people, understand that our country cannot succeed when a shrinking few do very well and a growing many barely make it. We believe that America's prosperity must rest upon the broad shoulders of a rising middle class. We know that America thrives when every person can find independence and pride in their work, when the wages of honest labor liberate families from the brink of hardship. We are true to our creed when a little girl born into the bleakest poverty knows that she has the same chance to succeed as anybody else because she is an American, she is free, and she is equal, not just in the eyes of God, but also in our own. We understand that outworn programs are inadequate to the needs of our time. So we must harness new ideas and technology to remake our government, revamp our tax code, reform our schools, and empower our citizens with the skills they need to work harder, learn more, reach higher. But while the means will change, our purpose endures. A nation that rewards the effort and determination of every single American. That is what this moment requires. That is what will give real meaning to our creed. We, the people, still believe that every citizen deserves a basic measure of security and dignity. We must make the hard choices to reduce the cost of health care and the size of our deficit. But we reject the belief that America must choose between caring for the generation that built this country and investing in the generation that will build its future. For we remember the lessons of our past, when twilight years were spent in poverty and parents of a child with a disability had nowhere to turn. We do not believe that in this country freedom is reserved for the lucky or happiness for the few. We recognize that no matter how responsibly we live our lives, any one of us at any time may face a job loss or a sudden illness or a home swept away in a terrible storm. The commitments we make to each other through Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security, these things do not sap our initiative, they strengthen us. They do not make us a nation of takers, they free us to take the risks that make this country great. We, the people, still believe that our obligations as Americans are not just to ourselves, but to all posterity. We will respond to the threat of climate change, knowing that the failure to do so would betray our children and future generations. Some may still deny the overwhelming judgment of science. But none can avoid the devastating impact of raging fires and crippling drought and more powerful storms. The path towards sustainable energy sources will be long and sometimes difficult. But America cannot resist this transition. We must lead it. We cannot cede to other nations the technology that will power new jobs and new industries. We must claim its promise. That's how we will maintain our economic vitality and our national treasure. Our forests and waterways, our croplands and snow-capped peaks, That is how we will preserve our planet, commanded to our care by God. That's what will lend meaning to the creed our fathers once declared. We, the people, still believe that enduring security and lasting peace do not require perpetual war. Our brave men and women in uniform, tempered by the flames of battle, are unmatched in skill and courage. Our citizens, seared by the memory of those we have lost, know too well the price that is paid for liberty. The knowledge of their sacrifice will keep us forever vigilant against those who would do us harm. But we are also heirs to those who won the peace and not just the war, who turned sworn enemies into the surest of friends, and we must carry those lessons into this time as well. We will defend our people and uphold our values through strength of arms and rule of law. We will show the courage to try and resolve our differences with other nations peacefully, not because we are naive about the dangers we face, but because engagement can more durably lift suspicion and fear. America will remain the anchor of strong alliances in every corner of the globe, and we will renew those institutions that extend our capacity to manage crisis abroad. For no one has a greater stake in a peaceful world than its most powerful nation. We will support democracy from Asia to Africa, from the Americas to the Middle East, because our interests and our conscience compel us to act on behalf of those who long for freedom. And we must be a source of hope to the poor, the sick, the marginalized, the victims of prejudice, not out of mere charity, but because peace in our time requires the constant advance of those principles that our common creed describes: tolerance and opportunity, human dignity, and justice. We, the people, declare today that the most evident of truths, that all of us are created equal, is the star that guides us still, just as it guided our forebears through Seneca Falls and Selma and Stonewall, just as it guided all those men and women, sung and unsung, who left footprints along this great mall, to hear a preacher say that we cannot walk alone, to hear a king proclaim that our individual freedom is inextricably bound to the freedom of every soul on earth. It is now our generation's task to carry on what those pioneers began. For our journey is not complete until our wives, our mothers, and daughters can earn a living equal to their efforts. Our journey is not complete until our gay brothers and sisters are treated like anyone else under the law. For if we are truly created equal, then surely the love we commit to one another must be equal as well. Our journey is not complete until no citizen is forced to wait for hours to exercise the right to vote. Our journey is not complete until we find a better way to welcome the striving, hopeful immigrants who still see America as a land of opportunity, until bright young students and engineers are enlisted in our workforce rather than expelled from our country. Our journey is not complete until all our children, from the streets of Detroit to the hills of Appalachia to the quiet lanes of Newtown, know that they are cared for and cherished and always safe from harm. That is our generation's task, to make these words, these rights, these values of life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness real for every American, Being true to our founding documents does not require us to agree on every contour of life. It does not mean we all define liberty in exactly the same way or follow the same precise path to happiness. Progress does not compel us to settle centuries-long debates about the role of government for all time, but it does require us to act in our time. For now, decisions are upon us, and we cannot afford delay. We cannot mistake absolutism for principle, or substitute spectacle for politics, or treat name-calling as reasoned debate. We must act. We must act knowing that our work will be imperfect. We must act knowing that today's victories will be only partial, and that it will be up to those who stand here in 4 years, and 40 years, and 400 years hence to advance the timeless spirit once conferred to us in a spare Philadelphia hall. My fellow Americans, the oath I have sworn before you today, like the one recited by others who serve in this Capitol, was an oath to God and country, not party or faction. And we must faithfully execute that pledge during the duration of our service. But the words I spoke today are not so different from the oath that is taken each time a soldier signs up for duty, or an immigrant realizes her dream. My oath is not so different from the pledge we all make to the flag that waves above and that fills our hearts with pride. They are the words of citizens, and they represent our greatest hope. You and I, as citizens, have the power to set this country's course. You and I, as citizens, have the obligation to shape the debates of our time, not only with the votes we cast, but with the voices we lift in defense of our most ancient values and enduring ideals. Let us, each of us now, embrace with solemn duty and awesome joy what is our lasting birthright. With common effort and common purpose, with passion and dedication, let us answer the call of history and carry into an uncertain future that precious light of freedom. Thank you, God bless you, and may He forever bless these United States of America.
That was President Obama giving his second inaugural address. I'm Leonard Lopate, and you're listening to WNYC AM FM and HD New York, WNJT FM Trenton, WNJO 90.3 Toms River, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJP 88.5 Sussex. The president said that our rights are self-evident, but they're not self-executing. He brought up taking care of the poor, spending on infrastructure, school reforms, investing in our future. He said that all citizens deserve a basic measure of security and dignity. He brought up his commitment to Medicare and Social Security. And we bring you now, while Kelly Clarkson sings, Washington Post opinion writer and MSNBC contributor Jonathan Capehart. Jonathan, what stood out for you?
What stood out for me, quite frankly, Leonard, was the president's open embrace of gay and lesbian Americans. I don't think I have ever heard a sitting president speak so forthrightly during an inaugural address about a section of the American people that still, to this day, feels marginalized. And second-class citizens. And so my mind is sort of a swirl with thoughts and emotions that, you know, President Obama has been pretty clear during his presidency about what he thinks and how he feels about gay Americans. But I think it's the power and the symbolism of an inaugural address, and especially this being his second inaugural address, that gives this added weight and added importance. When he said earlier on in his speech, you know, we the people declare today that the most evident of truths, that of all of us are created equal, is the star that guides us still, just as it guided our forebears through Seneca Falls and Selma and Stonewall.
Mm-hmm.
That was a pretty powerful moment.
And actually, two of the other people participating in this event underscore that to some degree. Richard Blanco, the poet who will be going to in just a few moments, has explored both his Cuban and gay identities in his work, which mm-hmm. includes City of 100 Fires, Directions to the Beach of the Dead, which won the Pan American Beyond Margins Award in 2006, and also Looking for the Gulf Motel. And also the Reverend Dr. Luis Leon will be delivering the benediction. He
has a chance to succeed as anybody else because she is an American. She is free, and she is equal, not just in the eyes of God, but also in our own. We understand that outworn programs are inadequate to the needs of our time. So we must harness new ideas and technology to remake our government, revamp our tax code, reform our schools, and empower our citizens with the skills they need to work harder, learn more, reach higher. But while the means will change, our purpose endures. A nation that rewards the effort and determination of every single American. That is what this moment requires. That is what will give real meaning to our creed. We, the people, still believe that every citizen deserves a basic measure of security and dignity. We must make the hard choices to reduce the cost of health care and the size of our deficit. But we reject the belief that America must choose between caring for the generation that built this country and investing in the generation that will build its future. For we remember the lessons of our past, when twilight years were spent in poverty, and parents of a child with a disability had nowhere to turn. We do not believe that in this country freedom is reserved for the lucky or happiness for the few. We recognize that no matter how responsibly we live our lives, any one of us, at any time, may face a job loss or a sudden illness, or a home swept away in a terrible storm. The commitments we make to each other through Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security, these things do not sap our initiative, they strengthen us. They do not make us a nation of takers, they free us to take the risks that make this country great. We, the people, still believe that our obligations as Americans are not just to ourselves, but to all posterity. We will respond to the threat of climate change, knowing that the failure to do so would betray our children and future generations. Some may still deny the overwhelming judgment of science, but none can avoid the devastating impact of raging fires and crippling drought and more powerful storms. The path towards sustainable energy sources will be long and sometimes difficult, but America cannot resist this transition. We must lead it. We cannot cede to other nations the technology that will power new jobs and new industries. We must claim its promise. That's how we will maintain our economic vitality and our national treasure. Our forests and waterways, our croplands and snow-capped peaks. That is how we will preserve our planet, commanded to our care by God. That's what will lend meaning to the creed our fathers once declared. We, the people, still believe that enduring security and lasting peace do not require perpetual war. Our brave men and women in uniform, tempered by the flames of battle, are unmatched in skill and courage. Our citizens, seared by the memory of those we have lost, know too well the price that is paid for liberty. The knowledge of their sacrifice will keep us forever vigilant against those who would do us harm. But we are also heirs to those who won the peace and not just the war, who turned sworn enemies into the surest of friends, and we must carry those lessons into this time as well. We will defend our people and uphold our values through strength of arms and rule of law. We will show the courage to try and resolve our differences with other nations peacefully, not because we are naive about the dangers we face, but because engagement can more durably lift suspicion and fear. America will remain the anchor of strong alliances in every corner of the globe, and we will renew those institutions that extend our capacity to manage crisis abroad. For no one has a greater stake in a peaceful world than its most powerful nation. We will support democracy from Asia to Africa, from the Americas to the Middle East, because our interests and our conscience compel us to act on behalf of those who long for freedom. And we must be a source of hope to the poor, the sick, the marginalized, the victims of prejudice, not out of mere charity, but because peace in our time requires the constant advance of those principles that our common creed describes: tolerance and opportunity, human dignity, and justice. We, the people, declare today that the most evident of truths, that all of us are created equal, is the star that guides us still, just as it guided our forebears through Seneca Falls and Selma and Stonewall, just as it guided all those men and women, sung and unsung, who left footprints along this great mall, to hear a preacher say that we cannot walk alone, to hear a king proclaim that our individual freedom is inextricably bound to the freedom of every soul on earth. It is now our generation's task to carry on what those pioneers began. For our journey is not complete until our wives, our mothers, and daughters can earn a living equal to their efforts. Our journey is not complete until our gay brothers and sisters are treated like anyone else under the law. For if we are truly created equal, then surely the love we commit to one another must be equal as well. Our journey is not complete until no citizen is forced to wait for hours to exercise the right to vote. Our journey is not complete until we find a better way to welcome the striving, hopeful immigrants who still see America as a land of opportunity, until bright young students and engineers are enlisted in our workforce rather than expelled from our country. Our journey is not complete until all our children, from the streets of Detroit to the hills of Appalachia to the quiet lanes of Newtown, know that they are cared for and cherished and always safe from harm. That is our generation's task, to make these words, these rights, these values of life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness real for every American. Being true to our founding documents does not require us to agree on every contour of life. It does not mean we all define liberty in exactly the same way or follow
the same precise path to happiness. Progress does not compel us to settle centuries-long debates about the role of government for all time, but it does require us to act in our time. For now, decisions are upon us, and we cannot afford delay. We cannot mistake absolutism for principle, or substitute spectacle for politics, or treat name-calling as reasoned debate. We must act. We must act knowing that our work will be imperfect. We must act knowing that today's victories will be only partial, and that it will be up to those who stand here in 4 years, and 40 years, and 400 years hence to advance the timeless spirit once conferred to us in a spare Philadelphia hall. My fellow Americans, the oath I have sworn before you today, like the one recited by others who serve in this Capitol, was an oath to God and country, not party or faction. And we must faithfully execute that pledge during the duration of our service. But the words I spoke today are not so different from the oath that is taken each time a soldier signs up for duty, or an immigrant realizes her dream. My oath is not so different from the pledge we all make to the flag that waves above and that fills our hearts with pride. They are the words of citizens, and they represent our greatest hope. You and I, as citizens, have the power to set this country's course. You and I, as citizens, have the obligation to shape the debates of our time, not only with the votes we cast, but with the voices we lift in defense of our most ancient values and enduring ideals. Let us, each of us, now embrace with solemn duty and awesome joy what is our lasting birthright. With common effort and common purpose, with passion and dedication, let us answer the call of history and carry into an uncertain future that precious light of freedom. Thank you, God bless you, and may He forever bless these United States of America.